From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Jose.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, we continue our series on the redevelopment of the Bayview Hunters Point Shipyard. Today, who's moving in?
One of the things that is my priority is to ensure that there's zero displacement, particularly around folks in public housing.
Then a Berkeley playwright says it's high time to update how his city is identified.
The free speech movement was 50 years ago. That's a long time for a place to have an identification connected with it.
And an East Oakland native is starting a company to turn her neighborhood around.
I see a lot of kids and they haven't even got to kindergarten and they're already on the wrong track.
Redeveloping, redefining, and redirecting. Today on Cross Currents. One of the most significant changes happening now in San Francisco is taking place in Bayview Hunters Point. It's been nearly 40 years since the Navy ended its activities there. Now its shipyard is being redeveloped. Within the next 5 years, 1,400 new homes will be built, with nearly 12,000 more in the years to come. The neighborhood will soon look very different, but right now it's one of the most impoverished in the city. So who will live in the revitalized shipyard?
There will be affordable homes for the local community people and others in San Francisco.
That's Danny Cook, an executive vice president with the developer Lennar Urban.
We're required to meet certain percentages on affordable and average requirements for the local income for a family.
But in a city with a history of displacing African Americans, that promise is often greeted by skepticism. Today, we're continuing our series on the San Francisco shipyard by considering the question of housing. KALW's Daphne Matsiaraki reports.
Linda Richardson is sitting in her car just outside a huge fenced-off construction zone. This is where Lennar is slowly building a new development at the site of the abandoned Navy shipyard. Richardson is a longtime resident and community activist, and she wants to show me who will be most affected by the redevelopment.
This one's Marina Village. This were part of the shipyard long time ago. This is where, when the shipyard was in existence, the Navy workers lived here.
So who lives here now?
They live there now is an ordinary folks that live there now, and it's also mixed-use income, the low income, the people here.
These homes still look like army barracks. They're run down.
This is called MCO Properties. It's a very low-income housing. It's probably 30 or 40 years old or more. This is a low income.
There is trash on the streets. Almost nothing seems kept. More than a third of the city's public housing is in Bayview Hunters Point, a neighboring Potrero.
You could see the public housing there. Can you see the public housing?
Yes.
That's a lot of crime there.
As we continue towards 3rd Street, the neighborhood changes. Houses are nicely painted, the streets are cleaner, and the cars park here are pretty new. At the end of the block, though, there is a barricade.
The reason they block it up because they have public housing, a lot of crime.
This community wasn't always like this. People here used to make a good living when the shipyard was open. But the neighborhood gradually disintegrated after 1974, when the shipyard closed down. Richardson takes me to one of the biggest public housing projects in the area.
This area is called Hunter's View.
Mm-hmm.
These are the old units, and they have been demolished.
Residents have already started moving into the new apartments. The city is spending $100 million on infrastructure and rental homes over the next 2 years.
And you can see what the new ones are going to be. So if you're low income and you're going to live in there, I don't think the mayor of San Francisco has a view like that.
Richardson owns a home here. She thinks a redevelopment of the shipyard will benefit the entire community. Lanisha Jefferson, on the other hand, does not.
I was born and raised over here, but I feel like it's no help. That Navy Yard is not going to be given the opportunity that they should, that they claim they're giving.
She's not worried that the renovated shipyard won't provide opportunities. It's more who it will provide these opportunities for.
I feel like a lot of people who are going to be able to afford that is going to be a little higher middle class, maybe upper class. They're trying to appeal and get more whites in this area because it is a crime rate over here, violence, a lot of stuff goes on. So, of course, they're trying to clear it all out and start over.
Jefferson says the construction that started on housing projects in this community is already changing the neighborhood's complexion.
You know, they're remodeling up in West Point and all these places, but a lot of people moving, like half the people can't even afford to move back there. They say it's low income, but then it's, you have to think your credit report.
The city says that credit score is not a factor for existing residents. But Jefferson's concern is not lost on District Supervisor Malia Cohen.
So this fear of displacement, this fear of being pushed out is real, and I empathize with it, and I can completely understand that fear.
Cohen represents District 10, which contains the shipyard and surrounding neighborhoods.
Another thing that I'm real focused on is I want to make sure that we're not concentrating poverty into one or two or a few isolated pockets.
That's largely the case right now in San Francisco. Poverty is concentrated in the Tenderloin, south of Market, in parts of the Mission, and near the shipyard.
I want to make sure that we are able to, that we're creating housing on every income level, that we are not just spending resources and allowing luxury development to happen, and then public housing.
Even if nobody gets displaced, though, the new development may drive the market prices up. And that will mean wealthier people moving into a neighborhood that has suffered more foreclosures than any other in San Francisco.
I would imagine the value of the land will increase. I mean, that's just the general trend of the market. Unfortunately, I don't have the ability to control, neither does the board. No one really has the ability to control the market trend.
There was concerns about increased price pressure on housing, which we took into account in our planning process.
Thor Koslovsky is the project manager for the Hunters Point Shipyard for the city of San Francisco. In cooperation with Lennar, they are responsible for the implementation of the entire project.
And so we have a very strong affordable housing program.
Here are the numbers.
On average, it's 32%. The affordable housing program has sort of a variety of ways that we get at affordable housing to help folks come live here.
So in the next 5 years, Lennar will build about 1,400 units. 461 will be considered affordable.
And affordable today, if I remember some of the numbers, were in the mid to upper 60,000 per year for a family of four. And a lot of teachers, working class people, fire people, people in the police department can afford it with their salaries.
That's the first phase. The second promises another 11,500 units, a third of which will be considered affordable.
We've used that opportunity to rebuild, you know, a very dilapidated area of the city.
Lennar's promises include almost $29 million paid to a community first housing fund. It is to help neighborhood residents with things like down payment assistance if they want to purchase a home in the revitalized shipyard. It's the kind of thing that Linda Richardson has been wishing for.
They're waiting from the shipyard when it's built. It would generate economic opportunities for them. People will be able to locate their businesses there. People will be able to work in there. And that's the hope.
Richardson says that this redevelopment has been an enormous experiment in which the community, the city, and the developer have worked together to avoid displacement. In a few years, she will know if that work can actually offset the pressures of one of the nation's hottest housing markets. In San Francisco, I'm Daphne Mazziaracchi for Cross Currents.
Tomorrow, our series on the redevelopment of the shipyard continues. We'll consider the significance of jobs in the neighborhood, who's getting the work now, and who will get it in the future. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. As we observe a changing San Francisco, across the bay, Berkeley is also witnessing some major redevelopment. A new play tries to capture and preserve the diverse character of Berkeley through the stories of its people. Playwright Dan Wolf interviewed hundreds of people from all around Berkeley and asked them these three questions.
When did you come to Berkeley? Why do you stay in Berkeley? And then the fun one was, what's magical for you about Berkeley?
The answers to those questions inspired Wolf's play called Daylighting, the Berkeley Stories Project. His play includes a cast of characters from the retired UC professor to the homeless person living under a bridge to a woman in a wheelchair. The man who's called Berkeley home since the 60s and the new family that's just moved in. There's music throughout, and it's all seen through the eyes of the young protagonist, B. Playwright Dan Wolf came by our studios, and I asked him what the motivation was for the play. We start with a clip from a character, James, who's been in Berkeley since 1975.
Berkeley, California! It's that time in the middle of the night when you can't tell if it's too late to be up or too early to be coming home.
Well, I moved to Berkeley about 6 years ago, right before my son was born. And it's one of those funny Sundays where you're out walking around and pushing a stroller and you start to see the people who you didn't know live there. And I ran into a friend of mine, Rebecca Novick, who's a director. And we said, I didn't know you lived here. I didn't know you lived here either. What is this place? Like, it's all these new families and, all the kind of history of Berkeley. Like, what is this place that we live in? And I think that coupled with the question of, how do you make work for your community is very kind of on my mind. And when you move from one community to another, who are you? Who are your neighbors? And how do you explore that? And we both looked at each other and said, let's make something. Coming out of the question, how do you make work in your community? And who comes to Berkeley? Who lives in Berkeley? Why? Why do you stay? All these things started to surface for us. And so we set out these questions that we would just ask people. And we met with probably 100 or 150 people over.
You interviewed a lot of people.
We talked to a lot of people. Yeah, we really did. And yeah, we just kind of started there and listened and heard. And a lot of people said, that's not Berkeley. This is Berkeley.
So what was your initial question? What was your...
It was when did you come to Berkeley? Why do you stay in Berkeley? And then the fun one was, what's magical for you about Berkeley? What's the one place, if someone came from out of town, that you would bring them? And we got these amazing answers. And of those answers, really the setting and the concept around what we were doing in the play was born.
Mm. So let's talk about the storyline. There's a Berkeley student named B.
Mm-hmm.
B as in Berkeley?
B as in Beatrice.
B as in Beatrice. And she is walking from the Berkeley Hills to the Flatlands throughout the play. So let's meet B first.
Uh-huh. Hey, baby, come on now. That's my baby right there.
Berkeley is history, proximity, and circumstance. Berkeley is a mystery. I'm used to me, a movement's fast. Berkeley is community. Its knowledge is collection. Berkeley is unity, utopia's extension.
So B is making this journey through Berkeley, but it's also a journey through time and space, and she meets all these people. What goes on along the way?
Well, first of all, I want to mention that the play takes place between midnight and sunrise on the night of her high school graduation. And so, she's starting at this party and she is aware of the history of Berkeley, specifically these creeks that used to be surfaced and now are underground. And she kind of used that as the metaphor for following and finding herself throughout the night. She's questioning, do I stay? Do I go? And she just starts off on a solitary solo, in a way, like spirit walk through the night. And everyone she meets is real, but they have that fantastical connection to her of, I know you, I've seen you somewhere. Are you on TV? You're in a picture at my grandfather-in-law's house. One of the things we heard was Berkeley doesn't have 6 degrees of separation. It has two. Every time you meet someone, you're like, oh, you were married to him. And somebody actually said that in one of the story circles. So I took that I took liberty, dramatic liberty, with that idea and kind of set her off on this walk through the night.
And she meets people.
She meets, you know, the kind of cast of Berkeley, and it's, you know, the different groups that we met along the journey of the process, which was, you know, the Ed Roberts group, the assisted living group, the disability community in Berkeley. She meets, you know, the revolutionary 60s, you know, came here for the fight, but now bought a house in the hills and lives in a gourmet ghetto, you know.
And she meets a day worker.
Yeah, she meets a day laborer called Manuel, who in the timeline of the story helps her move from her house. But in his arc, his narrative, he's just arrived in Berkeley. And we're really trying to show that at any given moment, the in and out flux is always happening. People are coming in and out of the place. The water is flowing in and out of the creek, in and out of the bay. You know, we're trying to transition in and out of moments in our life. And so she meets Manuel, and Manuel has this beautiful speech where he talks about his journey to the Bay Area, specifically Berkeley.
Well, let's listen to it.
And he said, "Hey, get out of my space. I'm asking for money here. Go over there. There. Mexicans over there." But I saw nothing. I was told that people start arriving around 5:30 in the morning. At 5:30, no one arrived. 6:30, no one.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba, and with me is playwright Dan Wolf. His new play, Daylighting, the Berkeley Stories Project, is showing now through June 22nd. So we just heard the day laborer, Manuel, and his monologue, one of the many stories included in the play. So the play's subtitle is There Ain't No One Berkeley. Mm-hmm. So do you feel you're, this is cliche to say, but breaking a stereotype of what people think Berkeley is, or who is someone from Berkeley?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, we purposefully didn't write a play about the 60s in Berkeley, and, you know, there's no scene that happens on Sproul Plaza. Nobody was even there, you know. So we're trying in a way to say, like, you know, the free speech movement was 50 years ago. That's a long time for a place to have an identification connected with it. And if it's still connected, is it true today? Just in the same way that San Francisco is connected with the San Francisco sound. But, you know, Jefferson Starship's been gone for a long time, you know. And so what is the sound? What is the ethos and the psyche of a place? And how do you tell a story about a place? And so we really, again, tried to say, like, Berkeley is many different things, and how can we explore as many of them as possible?
Right. And as you see, speaking of, you know, change and time, as you look at the changing, you know, San Francisco is changing and Oakland is changing, do you see Berkeley kind of following in that?
Yeah, I mean, there's the biggest kind of income disparity and one of the biggest in the country. And so, you know, these houses that, you know, were a couple $100,000 that nobody would want to live in 10 years ago are now $1 million houses. So our whole structures are shifting. And so the play, I hope, is getting at, in a very specific way, how we deal with these kind of seismic shifts that are happening in our on our neighborhood. And when is it a value to us that our house is now worth $1 million versus, you know, on the way out, it's always a value if you're selling the house. But on the way in, it's like, how can I afford to live here?
I'm talking about the kind of change I'm talking about. I'm talking about people standing up for themselves 24/7 without the fear of getting shot in the back or tear gassed or arrested.
Yeah, but changes in technology are mobilizing people all over the world. Past all that hippy-dippy protest stuff.
It's you people coming here, though, and making it more expensive.
That's right. Look at the housing costs.
Change is not comfortable.
That's right. Because black people can't live here anymore.
We got pushed out to Emeryville.
Change is superficial. Nothing changes. They just cut down more trees. The white people live here, the black people live there. Change, everything just stays the same.
You know, people are moving out all the time. And so, again, where are they going and who's replacing them? And how do we create an opportunity for as many people to sit at the table and share in the conversation?
playwright Dan Wolf's new play is Daylighting, the Berkeley Stories Project, showing at Shotgun Players Ashby Theater through June 22nd. If you go, you can record your Berkeley story in their booth. And if you're from Berkeley, we want to hear how you see the change in your city. Give us a call at 415-264-7106 and let us know. That number again, 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. While Dan Wolf has been collecting stories from Berkeley residents, KELW's Hear Hear project has been heading to libraries around Oakland and San Francisco, recording the stories of the people there. At the 81st Avenue Library in East Oakland, our Hear Hear producers met a woman who grew up in Oakland and says she's tired of all the difficulties young people face there today. So she's launching an organization called Planting Special Seeds to change that. It's a youth empowerment program that offers job training, educational advising, and emotional support to young people from around Oakland. Here's her story.
My name is Jeanette King Harris. I'm the CEO of Planting Special Seeds, a youth empowerment program here located in Oakland. And we're babes in the wood. We're just getting started. When I was 12, you know, when we got out of school, we had things to do. They had all kind of youth programs offered to us. And I just don't see the things happening now that was happening then. There's a little places here and there that may be doing something, but on a grand scale, I don't see anything. I see a lot of kids, and they haven't even got to kindergarten, and they're already on the wrong track. People are losing their children every day to all craziness, and all the drugs that are in Oakland. That's just ridiculous. You know, something got to be done about it. It should have been a state of emergency. I think God put us on here as parents and as role models to say, this is what you need to do for this kid. This kid needs this, you know, and if you don't give it to them, who else will? You know, all kids should have a goal to do something that's good in the world. Because it makes you feel good at the end of the day. If I help you, I'm going to feel good. I suppose to anyway, right? And you'll feel great about yourself because you will say, yeah, I fell down the wrong road, but life has bumpy roads, but you can always change your lane. Whatever I can do to try to turn it around, that's what Planting Special Seeds wants to do.
That was Jeanette King Harris. Her story was produced by Nina Gensler-Debs for KALW's Hear Hear Project. Find more Hear Hear stories at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time to hear from you. Last week, we aired a story about Laura's Law. It's a state law that allows courts to compel those with mental health issues to get outpatient treatment. After more than a decade since its passage, only two counties, Nevada County and just recently Orange County, have fully adopted it. Now, Alameda County is attempting to implement a version of the law, which centers on what proponents call assisted outpatient treatment, or AOT. So far, the effort has been controversial. On one side, parents and relatives say they need Laura's Law to help their loved ones. On the other side are many who've dealt with mental illness themselves who say their civil liberties are at stake, like Sally Zinman.
I know that people want to be compassionate and caring and help people, but helping people that don't want to be helped can equally be horrendous.
Well, a couple of you called in to share your thoughts on the issue. Here's what you had to say.
Hi, my name is Tony DeWitt, and I have to tell you that I have a sister that could not get help for her son. And no matter what she did, she was unable in our current system to find help. We need to stop discriminating against people with mental illness, and our system has to recognize that we need a change. This is not the 1960s where we have involuntary medication and where people lock you up and throw away the key. This is 2014, and we are losing people on the streets every day.
Next message.
My name is Patricia. If someone collapses in the street or is in a coma, We don't wait for them to realize they need help. You empower people by helping them to recover the ability to have agency in the world.
Those were the voices of listeners Tony DeWitt and Patricia Fontana. We always welcome your feedback on our stories. Leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and we may get your comment on the air. And that does it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Leela Day, Jasmine Lopez, Liz Pfeffer, Mary Reese, Seth Samuel, Mary Willis, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Line producer was Audrey Dilling. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thank you. We are listener-supported public radio. The blending of East and West that you're hearing in this music was created by the Ultra World Extet. Why an extet? Because they say the number of players and instruments keep changing. The Ultra World Extet will play on Friday at the Old First Church, that's on Sacramento Street in San Francisco. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.